Hi, and welcome to another episode of CineNation. I am Brandon Sparks.
And I am Ben Gertz.
Ben, you're in Portland, and it's hot. That's what you just told me.
I wasn't sure if I should bring all of my enthusiasm all at the beginning here or save it. So, yes, I don't have air conditioning in Portland, which you probably don't have air conditioning in L.A., do you, Brandon?
No, I do.
You do?
Yeah.
Oh, good gosh. Oh, my God. So this is the first time in my life, really, other than when I had an apartment in L.A., that I've lived significantly without air conditioning, and it is ridiculous. And I'm a whiner. I own up to that. But as an Alabama boy, I've never lived without air conditioning for this long. So anyway, that's my whining.
I love how you assumed
it's hot.
I did
it
not
is
have
so
air.
Hot.
I love how you assumed I did not have AC.
Most people in LA don't have it. Which like, most people up here don't have air conditioning.
That's true. Most of the time, we just open a window and it's whatever. So anyway, we're gonna talk a little bit about different things, the panels that we've been to, but also we're gonna talk
my
about like, what we've been watching. Last time Ben and I talked, I had just seen Jurassic World. And currently that movie has over $1.2 billion at the box office. So that's what can change in the matter of 3 weeks. And so, yeah, Ben, because you usually see less than me, let's talk about what you've seen. Let's talk about what you've seen
let's
first.
Pick on the guy that's sweating. Well, I was proud to announce to Brandon that I am now you, the audience, and I'm glad you're here. I went to go see a movie. I went to go see Inside Out with my son last night.
Which is really good.
You know, that is a really great film. Yeah. I had heard some like mixed things from people because I feel like the older you get and the more you read blogs and things, people get cynical and want to, you know, take shots at like feel good films like a Pixar film, right? It's like, you're not the target audience, okay? Like, you're just not the target audience if you're going to be Mr. Super Cynical. Like, go watch YouTube videos. Go, you know, read BuzzFeed articles. I thought it was fantastic. I mean, you know, the premise is just exceptional. The execution on it is just, you couldn't, you know, I'm thinking, my gears start turning as soon as I sit down and I see, like, I know where things are kind of going from the trailer and things, but I'm like, what are they going to do next? What are they going to do next? And it's like, oh, that is, you know, it's not a mind-altering, like, experimental project or something.
Yeah.
But there's just little cleverness all along the way.
Yeah, when I was watching it, I was with two friends, and, like, 15 minutes, and I'm just like, this is ingenious. Like, how, because I was like, the idea of Round It and what they were doing, I was like, I'm wondering how they're going to pull this off, because it's a very ambitious idea. For people who don't know, if you've not seen the Pixar trailer, basically what it is, it's the inner workings of a young girl's brain. And basically it's the main characters are these emotions, joy, anger, sadness, disgust, and fear. And
played by like all excellent like casting. You know what I mean? Like perfect casting.
Amy Poehler as Joy is like the big one. And the lady who plays Sadness, I don't know her name. The lady who plays Sadness is like this great, like...
There's some classic lines I know we're going to be hearing for the next decade, you know? Of like, she's got the bit about, like, I'm just going to lay here on the ground and just turn into a puddle or, you know, whatever it is. I'm not quoting it right.
Or it's like,
but
think of a good moment. Oh, I remember we watched that great movie where the dog died. That was...
And you know, like, I know, like, with any of these movies, any of these Pixar movies or Disney movies or whatever, like, if my son or, you know, if kids like it, it's going to be, like, everywhere. You know what I mean? Like, if they latch onto it, they never let it go, basically.
Look what happened to Frozen.
Let it go. You like how I set that up?
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen those movies, and I don't even have, like, you know, so far we don't have a little 7-year-old princess running around singing Let It Go. But, I mean, I've seen Frozen, you know, 10, 15 times. And I know people who say they've seen it hundreds. You know what I mean? So in my mind, I'm thinking, like, is this a good Pixar movie? Because I'm going to have to see it again. And, you know, it's great. Bing Bong. I mean, like, there's some great, silly characters and just cute. I mean, you know, the train of thought, like, it's a super obvious joke, but it just worked. Like,
yeah,
it, I don't know. Haters gonna hate.
No, I loved it, and it's like, it's, I put it up there as one of their best I've done, personally. Like, I was like, this might be, huh?
I mean, my brother Caleb, shout out from the show, he was like, greatest movie ever made.
Oh, I won't go that far. But I was like, I think I told people, like, this rivals, like, the Toy Story films. Like, I think it's very hard to top Toy Story, but this is, to me, that's like out, like right outside the trilogy of Toy Story, personally.
Well, and, you know, Caleb saw it in theater next to a young married couple, and the wife was pregnant, and, you know, he said they basically just, like, bawled the whole time. And you know, even from the short film before it, you know, the lava?
Yeah, the lava.
Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah.
Simple, just really well executed. I mean, it's not my favorite of the shorts that they've done, but, yeah, it pulls it all. That's a great primer for the film, right?
Yeah. Because
it's this, like, life journey of these volcanoes or whatever, right? And,
yeah.
And there's just so many things that... If you do have kids or whatever, I mean, it just tugs at all the right heartstrings, and, you know, just own up to it, cry a little bit, you know. It's really, and we won't give away the ending of the film necessarily, yeah. But I mean, like, all of those emotions are valid and important.
Yeah,
so we're just, yeah, the counseling. People, this is your little therapy.
This is the therapy. The people next to me that I was with, they were crying. That we get out, they're like, that was a sad movie. That was a sad movie. I was like, I thought it was great. I think it's a happy ending. But yeah, and it's doing very well for Pixar as well, which is the plus side for them, is that it's making money, and hasn't even opened in China yet. But anyway, and then last night I went to the Hollywood Bowl and saw Back to the Future with the full orchestra. So
that's cool.
That was exciting. And it's like, Christopher Lloyd was there, who plays Doc Brown. Leah Thompson was there, who plays
Marty.
Leah Thompson.
This is going to be my podcast of bad impersonations.
Best impersonations.
Marty.
Great Scott.
Where we're going, we don't need roads. All right, that's it.
Thank you.
That wasn't even an impersonation. That was just a...
That was just a line. That was just a line.
Yeah, I'm just reciting a line.
Anyway, with you, Brandon. It was a great experience, and we'll touch on this a little bit later, too, with the panels that I went to. Great experience, like, with thousands of people. The producer, Bob Gale, came out and said, oh, this is the largest audience to ever see Back to the Future. And it was a great experience, for sure. Like, I mean... As a filmmaker, I never realized how much music was actually in Back to the Future, and mm-hmm. you start to note when you have an orchestra, you start to notice, like, the moments that you can tell they actually picked, like, really decided upon where the music should be. It went with a lot of the emotional beats of the story, and it really worked. But I want to get to what you want to talk. Go ahead.
Well, did they rescore it, or did they actually just perform the same
score?
They
performed the same score. That's what they did.
Yeah, that's interesting. Because it kind of made me think, like, when you brought it up, like, you know, that it's almost an opportunity. I mean, Lucas has kind of already done it with Star Wars, where they've rescored the digital versions for whatever messed up Lucas reason, you know. But
yeah, as he does.
It would be interesting to come back to later, and not to try and erase history, but as a kind of, you know, hey, here's an alternate take on it. You know, that seems like a ultimate kind of fan nerd moment, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was, like I said, I never realized how much music was in the film, and it added so much to the experience of watching the movie. And, like, and also, too, just watching an old film in a huge audience. Like, people would clap during, like, moments of the film. It was like I was watching, like, Rocky Horror Picture Show, whatever, because, like, people, when Crispin Glover punches Biff, Crispin Glover's character punches, George McFly punches Biff, people just start applauding. And I'm like,
oh, yeah, that's a great moment.
It's a great moment. And it's like, and they kiss on the dance floor. It's like, yay! People, like,
I hope that was your cheer voice.
Yay!
Really, you're just telling a story about all the things you did when you were there.
I'm just telling you how I was the lone person screaming yay when George George and his
Everyone's gonna get on Twitter and be like, "Yeah, I was there."
No, I was there. It was just this weird guy in the middle who was just like randomly clapping at moments in the film.
No, it was
like I said, people would shout the lines out. There was a people like two people in front of me. Oh, the funniest one, two rows in front of me, and the part when Marty goes like, "I'll have a tab," which is like he asked for a drink or whatever. These four people just hold up tab cans and just yell, "Here!" And I'm like, you're kidding me. You Amazing. Actually brought tab drinks to this movie. They still
for that one moment. Yeah.
But yeah, it was a fun experience. I got to go with a bunch of people I know. But yeah, so I want to talk about what you want to talk about. And that's
I didn't know this is my show.
This is your show, Ben. This is your show. Anyway, we've both been recently watching the new season of True Detective, as probably a lot of people have, or who like the first
one. The anticipation was palpable throughout the internet.
No, it was because season one was such a huge success, and also too, I mean, the
barn burner.
Yeah, so the season one had a lot. There was some mixed reaction to the final ending of the season, but overall, people loved season one of True Detective. And then they announced the cast for True Detective season two with Colin Farrell and Rachel McAdams and Vince Vaughn and Taylor Kitsch, and it's like it's a very highly anticipated show, and comes out. And it's the big thing for me, because I know you're very big on like Cary Fukunaga and how
Fukunaga to the end, man. To the end.
I know. And, well, what happened, because we talked about this, I think, months ago. Like, I think we might have been still in Alabama. I'm not entirely positive. But we were talking about how
the location of our arguments is critical.
Critical, because we were actually in the same place with one another instead of cities apart. But you talked about how what helped was not that it was just one writer doing it all, but also a clear vision from directing side, and it was writer and director working together, which is how it should be. And now it's kind of delved into a more like traditional TV show, if that makes sense. Of like,
definitely.
Oh, this person is directing these two episodes. Like Justin Lin did the first two, this person's going to do the next two or whatever. It becomes like here handing off the reins to this next director who comes in and basically does what's told of him or her. And what helped was there was a clear vision of season one. And I think right now, what season two is lacking is that. Cause also too, I stand by this more than I stand the director part is, I think the switching, the big switch of the setting to Los Angeles had a major, I think it hurt the show personally, because like what helped the show, go ahead.
Well, I'm sorry, just to huff and puff, but no, so a lot of attention was paid last time around to Pizzolatto, Nick Pizzolatto, the writer, creator of the show. And, you know, he's from like the Texas area. His first novel, you know, is set in the Galveston area. And so there is that sense, like when I watched the first season, there was just that sense of, even though I'm not from Louisiana, like I've been down there.
Yeah.
There's a vibe and a rhythm and a visceral nature to that, to the tone of that whole season.
Yeah.
That feels authentic. Even if it is cranked to 11, right? I mean, there's so much of it that is ridiculous when you really kind of think like, this is crazy. But it feels, season two feels more like a person watched a bunch of corruption cop movies set in LA, and you know, put some Russ Cole lines in there to try and add some spice. But it is really difficult. After the first one, it was just like, it was difficult to say, how is this different in any way?
Yeah.
Than every other cop corruption, you know, city government thing set in LA. You know, just as far as like so many cliches.
It's dealing with transportation of some kind, which is like a lot of LA stories deal with. And I think with the South and like with Louisiana, that was like a character in itself, and it was something we haven't really seen that much on television or even film, like in that nature of like with that. And so
Definitely been a lot of Louisiana productions, but I would say that the thing that worked so well is again that thing of so many films that come to this, you know, Georgia or Louisiana or whatever, they're filmmakers from LA who may or may not have been from the South or whatever, but it feels like this imposed sort of reading of it. You know, it's this like, this is New Orleans, you know, and they have a couple quick shots of a big band marching down the street or something, right? And it's this whole thing that's like, it's like a tourism ad, but just darker because it's a movie. And and it just doesn't work because it's not, you know, it doesn't feel like their hands are down in the soil, like actually shaping something out of what's there. They're kind of imposing it on it. And that was the thing, is it felt like, especially Woody Harrelson's character, you know, that kind of played second fiddle to Matthew McConaughey for obvious reasons. But I mean, his character especially just felt so, you know, infused from that moment in time that the whole show is set up, you know, and I don't know what you would call Colin Farrell's character in True Detective, or his partner, the big guy with the loose tie that's like, we're the cops. I mean, it's just like it's the most ridiculous of the most ridiculous.
It's the guy from There's Something About Mary. That's what that guy's from.
Yeah.
Now, see, I like Colin Farrell's character. I know you don't entirely, but I like Colin Farrell's character. I think Vince Vaughn's a great actor, but they're just giving him bad dialogue to say. Like, it's just, there's sometimes it's just like, you're kind of talking about, it's like cliche gangster talk. And like,
I think what works so well is like Fukunaga, I will just call him Carrie, Team Carrie, because it's been a long day. It really has been a long day. But what works so well is there were just these moments that you can tell were deliberate and fought for, but felt very beautiful in the moment, which is that just timing of delivery.
Yeah.
The delivery and the rhythm of the show that is not necessarily on the page of the script, right? I mean, everyone wanted to attribute everything great about the first season to Pizzolatto. It's like, oh, his writing, his script, it's amazing. And yeah, he wrote a lot of the dialogue, or asterisks, maybe he didn't, because there's a whole plagiarism scandal that you need to look up on the internet. But that's aside. I mean, there's a way in which the delivery of it, the fact that all 8 episodes in the first season, you can just tell that there's a steady hand at the wheel that makes it all run smoothly. And I just feel like that's lacking now, because it's kind of like line. I mean, we're just hammering through some of these things, trying to find a tweetable moment from some of these characters. And it just, I don't know. Not that it's moving too slow to me, really. I mean, some people have said that the first episode, definitely, but it just seems like they're hunting for, here's where we're trying to catch your attention in a way that's, I don't know, just doesn't work.
And one of the problems is, because we're getting now more into analyzing this actual story, is this is how I feel, was that the first season, we were introduced to these characters together up front, and we had the plot right up front. There's been a murder, and basically we go off of that and find out who these characters are. Problem with the first episode to me was, we didn't know the plot yet. We're just going to go from character to character to character, so you find out kind of who these people are.
Dumb things about the characters, too. Yeah. I mean, let's be real. Like, there's some great articles that are like, every female character that we meet in the first, like, so far in the first couple episodes, are introduced by their, shall we say, bedroom preferences, right? I mean, this is not like, I don't know why I'm censoring that, but you know, it's just dumb is why I'm censoring. It's dumb because like, it's as shallow as it sounds. Like, it's fine if some people are like that. Yeah. But like literally almost every female character with a speaking part is involved in some way, as like, there's the webcam girl.
It's very true.
There's the fact that we're introduced to Rachel McAdams' character, like walking out of the bedroom, and he's like, "Oh, I didn't know you were into that." I mean, it's just dumb. Like, just it's fine if one character's that way. It just feels weird if it's a whole bunch of dudes, and the show's written by this dude, and every chick in the show.
Well, you had Taylor. Taylor Kitsch's girlfriend kind of the same way.
I mean, I don't have to go through the whole list. They're all that way. It's ridiculous. It's crazy.
I'm glad your point is that. No, anyway, but the first episode is just kind of like we're wandering, and then at the end it's like, oh, here's what the story's all about. And I think the actors are really talented. I just don't know if they're given the right moments. Because, like, for example, Vince Vaughn, I think, is a great actor. But a lot of this time, and this is a part that I think he could kill if it's done differently. Mm-hmm. But right now, there's a lot of just, like, empty moments. And it's just like, okay, you're playing cliche gangster right now. My favorite moment. Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Now, my favorite.
No, you go ahead with your favorite moment.
My favorite moment that Vince Vaughn has done the first two episodes, is when he goes, this guy gets beat up, like, on the street or whatever.
Yeah, and episode two.
And he does the fast talking Vince Vaughn stuff a little bit, but it's different. And now there's a lot more intention, and like you can tell that this guy is not a guy to mess with. And that is the best thing he's done in this show so far. Because like I was watching
it. Yeah, and I'll tell you the counterpoint to that, which is the same episode, is when he's walking into the
club,
the strip club.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that sequence to me was so indicative of, and I want to go back after season two's over and give season one another watch through. But to me, that felt like a classic example of what was so wrong tonally, right? Mm-hmm. Because that sequence was just so stock image, just almost student film-ish, you know? Mm-hmm. Like there were cliche upon cliche shots put together to say you're in a strip club and you're getting ready to talk to the main guy. I don't know, the lighting was weak, the camera movement was weak. I mean, obviously, let's preface this by saying we would all kill to be working on the follow-up to season one. I mean, you know what I mean? It's only because it's in the shadow of season one, clearly. Yes. But I think it leads to this, Brandon, which is like, is Ballers going to be more interesting to watch in the long run than True Detective Season 2?
Oh,
I haven't watched it yet, but I've heard more people talk about it. It's like, hey, it's pretty good.
I've watched Ballers. I've watched the first episode. I have episode 2 downloaded or recorded that I need to watch.
Careful, which one terminology says DVR.
I have DVR.
That means you have an account, and the other says, "Ooh, Brandon does not have an account."
No, I don't do it. But anyway, Ballers first episode. Ballers really shows how good of an actor The Rock can be. It's like he's not in this whole like shoot him up, beat him down type role. It's actually an acting role that he's getting to do, and I'm like, his charisma just like pops off screen, and he's just like, it works so well for this show. And again, I haven't seen episode 2, but first episode is an interesting show. And like, I wonder, cause I think it will get a season 2 if it continues to do well, it'll get a season 2. My question is, how will The Rock continue to play if he continues to do the show? How he can do the TV show with the movies he's doing, because his schedule is just like crazy for probably the next 5 years.
Oh, and I bet every moment he's awake, they would love to have him on a screen. I mean, he's fantastic, and I want to let's hit another one that just got picked up for a second season before it even premiered, which is Mr. Robot, this new show on USA. And I mainly wanted to bring it up with you because of the way that I found out about it through the way they promoted it, which I thought, you know, it was a traditional ad on, theverge.com, which is like a tech website a lot of people read, but, you know, so it's just a normal like TV shows premiering. But what was interesting is their website, whoismrrobot.com is actually this, you know, I mean, this depends on how you feel about all this stuff, but it's basically a transmedia promotion thing, right? Yeah. But so the whole show is premised on this guy who's a hacker, and the promotion basically takes you into a terminal, which is, you know, for like programming nerds, they're like, ooh. And I was talking about it with guys at work who had never really, they had like kind of heard of the show loosely, and then they started looking it up and they were like, yeah, I could watch this, because like the titles of the episodes are, like they end with .mov, which is like a, you know, movie file format. I don't have to explain that to you guys, but anyway, there's just a lot of attention to like, to the audience, to this smaller, you know, niche audience. And like, for example, they, the other thing they were doing that I thought was really interesting is the first two episodes are available for free on Twitch. To stream, which is just genius. Because, you know, I think it's interesting for a network like USA. I feel like they're a classic. They're going to be an interesting channel to watch over the next 5 years as all these people are cutting cable. If you're right on that bubble of like, are you a core cable channel to include in these new services, the Hoppers, you know, the Dish Network sort of thing where you can stream online, or if Apple TV comes out with a new subscription plan or whatever, if you don't, if you're not an ESPN, like, you know, ESPN's in, basically, they're going to make the cut. And, you know, you can go down, it's a short list. It's about 20 channels or less, usually, in the way they're setting these things up. But if you don't make that cut, you are so in trouble. Yeah. So in trouble. Because cable subscriptions are in decline, and, you know, the spiral is only going to get faster.
Yeah.
So you really need a show that can capture people's attention that don't have cable, maybe, you know, or whatever, that start to ask for it, or, you know, start to buy it on iTunes or whatever. Like, it's never going to quite match, but just getting that attention is worth it for a show like this and for a network, you know. I just think it's really interesting.
Yeah, what it's saying, I'm reading an article right now on it, is that it was pretty much released on every digital platform before it premiered on the network.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's
which is crazy.
Yeah, it says like it was on USA Now app, USANetwork.com, Hulu, YouTube, iTunes, Amazon Instant Video, Google Play, Xbox, like all this stuff. And then it's like, additionally, the show would be offered on Twitch, IMDb, EW.com, Hollywood Reporter, like all this, Verge.com, all this stuff. So it's,
yeah, I mean, they're basically giving the show away, is what's so interesting about it. Is like, I think 5 years ago, you would have had a really hard time making this push. Like, if you're the showrunner, you're like, okay, look, here's the deal. It's going to be a show about hackers. We're going to have this whole transmedia campaign. We're going to put it up online. And basically, we're going to put it online first. Mm-hmm. And then the executive who's like, you know, paying the bills is going to be like, so yeah, how do we make money again if we give it away for free? Mm-hmm. The conversation is just different now, you know, because, you know, their viewing numbers might actually be up. I don't know. That's the curious thing to look at, you know, is like, what were their actual numbers for when the show was played on cable, traditional cable? But I just don't think those numbers matter. I mean, they matter to advertisers, but I think they're willing to basically play a little bit longer game and make a bet. You know, you're making a show to grab people's attention, and you want to have the next, you know, Mad Men, the next Breaking Bad, the next show that everyone's talking about, and you're willing to kind of, you know, put it out there on the line. So I don't know. I'm gonna give the show a shot. I really want to watch through and see if they kind of live up to the hype, because the website is fascinating to dig through it. It's kind of got this Fight Club, you know, vibe of like, you know, and the Matrix of wake up, you know, the world is not as we see. And it's going to be, I'm excited for it. We're talking about it now. So it's, you know, it's worked.
Yeah. I think I'm reading on the ratings we were talking about. I think it had 2.7 million view before it premiered on cable.
Wow.
And
that's tracked by Nielsen with some of the different digital platforms?
It's TV by the numbers is what I'm looking at right now, which is like one of the websites that does a lot of it. But yeah, that's how much it apparently made before it was shown.
One of the guys at work said that he was on Twitch. You know, this is, you know, nerd friends at work. And they were like, yeah, I heard about the show because it crashed Twitch. And I was like, that's amazing. And he's like, well, you know, Twitch crashes a lot, but it brought the site down. And I don't know. I just think anything like that is like, yeah, put it on Twitch because you're going to like that. I saw some of the stuff on Reddit about it, right? I mean, there's a group of nerds who you want to turn into super fans who are going to end up, you know, pushing Hopper, Dish Network, Apple TV, you know, getting the buzz out online to say, hey, we really need this show as part of our, you know, quote unquote, not cable package, you know.
Yeah.
Streaming package, basically.
Yeah, and the guy who directed the first episode is the guy who did the original Girl with the Dragon Tattoo Swedish film.
David Fincher.
No, Niels Arden Oplev or whatever. But yeah, it's got 97% on Rotten Tomatoes right now. But like what you're talking about with, because it's a very transmedia type show. Like basically, because when I looked at some like the promotions for it, it's like kind of has this like Banksy feel to it, where they have they do like street art for it around major cities, and actually do like the guy, like the main character's like face on certain things. And so it's like basically it's using it as a way to push people towards the show. And I'm segueing into kind of what the panels that I went to is that a number of people that were at the panels kind of, or one of the people at least, talked about how transmedia.
Tell the viewers where you saw this. This was not just Brandon with his friends. This was Brandon at
The Academy.
Oh yes, The Academy.
It was like Academy. It was like the Academy Theater. It was this kind of open panel discussion of called the new audience and kind of the future of connecting with this new audience, because we're using a lot of different platforms to view what we call cinema and how we connect the new audience to cinema. And this one person that was talking, Henry Jenkins, who actually teaches at USC, he really wasn't like trying to state that. Like he was basically showing how history affects kind of what we're doing now. And it kind of goes through like, this is what we did before in the 20s or even in the turn of the century. And what kind of opened my mind up was how transmedia has been going on for a number of years, and not just how basically transmedia affects cinema. And he talked about the big person that kind of really started it was Disney, who used like his TV shows to promote his films, and then he used his TV shows to promote his park. And at the park, you could ride the rides from the movies that you grew up watching, or ride the rides of the TV shows that you watch every week. And then you can buy the merchandise that says you can take the movie or story home and live it there. And so, yeah, you were a big fan of this guy's speech because they're all on YouTube, by the way. We'll post it in the show notes of all of the people's videos. So I want to hear your thoughts on like what you saw or what you heard from Henry Jenkins and the rest of the people.
Well, first off, I mean, Jenkins is, you know, a nerd's nerd. I loved it. I mean, you know, he instantly brought facts and history, because I watched most of these talks. And, you know, you can get, this happens a lot at conferences and panels. People feel the need to be profound and inspirational, and this is what I did when I was your age, and all this sort of stuff right there, you know? And I loved that he was basically like, putting a context around all of these changes with history and just saying, no, the original, his narrative is so wonderful, like in hearing his talk. I mean, he sets it up and just says, you know, some of the initial works that people were doing were spectacles, and by their nature, you know, fit into a lot of these categories that we now make fun of. You know, it's really, a lot of the things that we've debated recently fall exactly within this, which is, you know, this, I think my favorite line from him actually is this thing that, you know, once humanity or, you know, whatever with the humanity, we'll just group us all together. Yeah. Once we create a new medium, that medium tends to never go away. Like, it doesn't disappear. Now, the ways in which it's delivered, the ways in which it's consumed, the ways in which we make it, all of these things change substantially. But he's like, you know, theater still exists, radio still exists, painting still exists. You know, we have photographs, but we still paint. landscapes, you know, and, you know, whatever. Like all of these things that in some ways you could say supersede.
Yes.
They don't kill off what's before. Now, you know, very few people are, you know, posting on Twitter about how, you know, they're not making enough money being a painter. I mean, you know, some people are, but it's such a small group to begin with. No one really is, you know, surprised, right? I mean, because it is this much smaller art form. But anyway, I just thought his frame that he set up was just so interesting in that, you know, this medium will not die. We will be talking about cinema for decades and years and years and years to come, but the ways in which we
view it,
maybe consume it or things like that, that changes. And I thought it was so fitting to be coming from like just a genuine like nerd's nerd. You know, I like instantly I was like, I love this guy. Just the moment he started talking, because he's just so articulate.
Yeah.
And you believe him because his slides are fantastic. You know, he's flipping through these great bits of like history throughout cinema, and it's like, oh my gosh, this is fantastic that he put all of that, condensed it down to such a tight narrative. Yeah. I thought it was a really great talk worth watching.
And he talked about too, like, and we kind of go through it now with the way, like, how to, he didn't say it in this way, but how to bring people into theaters, because like I said, we're just talking about kind of what we've been talking about the past few shows, is that we create new ways of doing it. Like in the 50s you had the Cinerama, like on a larger scale, surround sound. He talks about how like 3D came, 3D went, and 3D came back again. And that's kind of how what I think studios or theaters are starting to do now is, in order to get people back into the theaters, they're doing these things like 3D or IMAX or, oh gosh, the new sound systems like Dolby Atmos and things like that, to create it more of an experience and more of an event. But yeah, he does a great job of, from like turn of the century to present day, of how we're doing it. Like you said, talks about how cinema, the future of it will not be a one singular way of viewing it. It'll be on multiple different platforms. There will still be theaters. There will still be viewing it on your phone or your home entertainment system or whatever. And like the big thing, I think, like you're talking about, like mediums never die. He says like businesses might, like talking about multiplexes, might close, but theaters themselves, like theaters, like movie palace, there's still movie palaces that still exist since the 30s that still show films. So yeah, it's never gonna go away. And then to talk about,
I think,
go ahead.
Well, yeah, I think a great tie-in is Z Frank's talk.
Yeah,
right. He's the head of production at BuzzFeed, I guess, is what they call it.
Yeah, Motion Pictures, BuzzFeed Motion Pictures.
I mean, come on. But anyway, just, you know, call it what it, it's not that I'm looking down at BuzzFeed. It's much more the, like, the reason you would name it the motion picture, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's
is it not Motion Pictures, though?
Okay. So let me go ahead and talk about what he nailed in a pretty great way was this. It's a great layperson's introduction to this idea of like media having different jobs to be done. You know, he was kind of like, we use it for different reasons is another way you can say it, which is, you know, sometimes we're really just sharing stuff to express a part of our identity, or, you know, we're sharing stuff because it's like, this made me feel this way, I hope you feel this way.
Yeah.
And kind of walking through that of how cinema, as we talk about like highbrow cinema, film, you know, that will always probably continue in some form. And these other things that are, you know, he made some really great analogies and comparisons to say that they reinforce each other in a lot of different ways because they are actually different things. You know, cinema is a chance to kind of be absorbed by what you're watching, to suspend your disbelief, right? That's the common thing we talk about in film school and things like that, right? And what is shared online and the things that we watch, you know, the Taylor Swift music videos that have 100 million views, I mean, you're not necessarily watching that to, like, you know, to suspend your disbelief that Taylor Swift is awesome, because she is awesome. It's much more that, you know, you're sharing it with people potentially to you know, express like affinity with this brand or this song or this, you know, idea or whatever, right? These,
yeah,
a lot of these shareable videos that he uses as examples are things that are kind of beneath Hollywood in many ways, but are still fundamentally solving why people want media, you know, to express themselves and to have different ways of articulating the human experience. So, I mean, it was a very, you know, it was a great defense of what he does, right? If you think, if you're one of the people who thinks that people like BuzzFeed need to defend their actions, I guess, you know.
No, but yeah, talking about the just one thing, because what you talked about too in the pre-show was how everyone kind of went off Henry Jenkins. And one of the things that Jenkins talks about that, that Frank ends up bringing up is how things, it's not really viral, but spreadable. How things to get spread, like how someone, like he goes in like the identity of it, like you're talking about, of continuing a conversation that you have with someone, like, oh, this is what we were talking about yesterday. And it's kind of like, I kind of like, for example, it kind of happened to me like yesterday. I showed, or I watched a trailer of a film trailer of the new movie called Creed that's a spinoff of Rocky. If you don't know about this.
Yes,
there's a spinoff of
Creed
Rocky.
Rocky not Rocky Bullwinkle. Oh gosh.
Rocky Balboa. Yeah. Okay. So it's directed by a guy
like Apollo Creed. Apollo Creed?
Apollo Creed's
Isn't
son
that the guy?
Is who it is.
Oh.
And
can
it's directed
you take me higher. Yeah, that's my last impersonation for the show.
It's directed by the guy, Ryan Coogler, who did Fruitvale Station. And it stars Michael B. Jordan as Apollo Creed's son. And then, so I was like, that's a weird choice for you to do, Coogler, like as a big drama, like Fruitvale, and then you go and do like a spinoff franchise film. And I watched the trailer.
Some people need to make money, Brandon.
No, I know. But like, I was like, that's a weird like choice, I thought, for him. But yeah, the trailer is on point. Like, it is, ooh, like, I don't say that very, I've watched it 4 times since yesterday. Like,
whoa, Brandon, yeah, it's not a movie.
But it's so great. So, like, I sent it to a friend of mine through a text message. He goes, oh my God, I love this. He posted online. Yeah. This person posts online. And then, it doesn't go viral, but it starts to be spreaded amongst our group of friends on Facebook.
Well, and shareable
online
probably is a better way to think about it, because viral has the, you know, kind of implication that it's like the cold where you don't mean to, and oops, I accidentally got you sick. You know, like I accidentally sent a Taylor Swift video to everyone at work because I'm like, this is amazing. but I send it because, or let's use another example. Kevin Gates, I Don't Get Tired. It's a rap music video, so I don't know if that's, you know, too much for people, but you know, the title, I Don't Get Tired, and the whole riff of the song is like, I got 6 jobs, I don't get tired. Sometimes at work, that's a relevant thing to say, of like, I end my emails with the, you know, the hashtag that he uses, IDGT or whatever, however you abbreviate that. It's been a long, long day, Brandon, and so I send out Kevin Gates stuff. So it's shareable. Yeah. It's not
spreadable,
necessarily viral. Spreadable. I'm spreading it because I'm saying this is a part of how I'm trying to, you know, express myself at work, which, yes, I work at a special place where you can send rap videos to each other, but it works.
But yeah, it's
it works.
So yeah, he it's shows that, and also too, because it goes into another video that the Academy did, is how we how we consume content, and how a lot of people say, like, oh, this one guy in the video, he's like, oh, like, people say this generation has a short attention span. He's like, there are people who binge watch House of Cards in less than 2 days. That says to me they have a long attention span, as long as you give them good content to watch. And that's something I think, With streaming and whatever, we're becoming, if you tell a good story, people will flock to it, I feel. Even if it's streaming, even if it's in the theaters, if it's on television, if you're telling a good story, people will flock to it, and people will spread their comments or their views on that show, film, or video, and everything.
Yeah, so, and I think, you know, like Lasseter's talk is a little wandering to not necessarily join Team Lasseter, and I know that that infuriates some of our audience members.
Well, because I was there, I will say this: to be there and hear John Lasseter speak, he could read the phone book for an hour.
Hickory dickory dock.
He could say whatever.
He could do anything. No, I agree with you.
I wouldn't care. So like me there, I'm like, oh my gosh. And the thing is, John Lasseter, he dropped a lot of inspiration bombs, is what I say. Well, because and a lot of stuff that I see a lot of young filmmakers do, it's like, oh, like there's a 4K camera. I gotta shoot everything I do on a 4K camera. I don't know how to use it, and I don't know if it goes with the story, but it's the best camera out there. And like he's saying, like, use the technology to the story. And if you're gonna use it, make sure you know everything about it. Because like that's the thing too, is that people think, oh, this technology is great, I have to use it. One of the most used cameras in filmmaking today, or high end filmmaking, is like the Arri Alexa, which is like a 2.6K. It's not 4K, it's not 8K, which is coming out like soon. It's a 2.6K. It's not the best resolution, but it works for the stories that people are telling. And so Lasseter kind of talks about, like, use the technology as a way to tell a story. And he talks about...
And really, like, a way that he kind of talks... He mentions it, you know, directly, kind of, and kind of grazes off of it. I wish it would have been more of his emphasis. But, you know, it's the ways in which new technology allows new stories. You know, new techniques emerge from new tools. And I think that's the really fascinating thing that Jenkins kind of brings up. Z. Frank is in the trenches of it, you know, at BuzzFeed talking about it. And then Lasseter kind of just decides that iPhones and GoPros are the cameras that everyone needs to use. you know, he repeats them over and over, which is fine. Like, I'm being a little... I think I'm being a little harsh because I actually read his article. Well, it's a summary of his speech from the Academy that they put on Medium.com.
Yeah,
it's just kind of a basically a blog post, you know, summarizing his talk. And it's direct quotes from the talk, and it's a little bit edited. And so when I watched it, I was like, oh, I've actually, you know, heard him say a lot of these things already. But it's that way in which because these tools are changing. And yet the grammar stays the same in many ways. The fundamentals. I talked about this back in my day when I was teaching editing classes and things. You know, it's like you need to be able to cut just a dialogue scene.
Yeah.
You know, get into the room, get into the setup, and cut back and forth and exit and have that work before you have ninjas and time travel and... You know, I mean, people can make whatever they want for YouTube and things like that, but so many of the assignments that students hated, and so, you know, whatever. It's not that they hated it. It's just more that everyone feels like it's beneath them. I felt the same way in school. It's like, this is beneath me. I've seen enough movies. I know how to hold a camera. And no, not at all. That's why they forced us to make silent films for so long, like in film school. It's like, you don't need to worry about dialogue. That's not, I mean... You know, if you're in the writing portion of it, you do. But
for cinematography,
for directing, you need to be able to handle the space that you're in. You need to be able to get coverage. All these things that feel quote unquote beneath you. Mm-hmm. Those fundamentals of the grammar and the really, like, you know, the key thing that I've learned whenever I've gone out and tried to shoot things is just in that moment on set when you're trying to figure things out. Like, do you have a history and like a, you know, do you have good form when you shoot the basketball, right? I mean, have you practiced layups and have you practiced free throws? Because if you miss, you know, if you miss back-to-back layups, like you're not going to be hitting half-court shots. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like that's not your problem. Your problem is you don't have the fundamentals down. So practice dribbling just over and over. And it's in other creative arenas, or fields, like people don't necessarily scoff at that, but you know, people get their hands on a camera and they think like, I'm just gonna go make a movie. Avant-garde,
yeah,
you know, movie, like no big deal. And it's like, no, just, you know, get those core things
it's
that carries you so far.
It's like, I don't have to know movies. I can just go out and make it. I can pick up a camera and I know exactly what I'm doing already. I've seen 3 or 4 movies. I should be good. Because some people say,
oh, Brandon, you know you're over that. Yeah. How many are you up to? Over 2K? You're what? Up towards like an Arri Alexa of your film patronage?
I know my
Netflix count is up over like 1,200 or something, which is...
That's different.
Positive to negative-ish.
I think I'm calculating how many movies I've seen in my lifetime. Sadly, my roommate dared me to do it, and I think I'm a little over 3,000, but I'm not positive.
Have you tried? Do you use Letterboxd? Have we talked about this?
I don't think we have. I think you,
you know
might,
what I'm talking about.
I think you might have invited me to it, and I've never done it.
Oh, Brandon. I think you would love it, and I guess I'm now telling it to the show. I haven't gotten on in a while, but
sponsored by Letterboxd.
Sponsored by Letterboxd. It's a really cool way to catalog and kind of, you know, create wish lists and all these. Like it, I switched over to it when Netflix stopped kind of allowing you to, you know, when I had the DVD service, you could kind of just find any film out there basically.
Yeah.
And, you know, rate it or make note of it or whatever, and
like Flixster, and they kind of Flixster,
yeah, Flixster. And when they kind of changed that, it made it much more convoluted. I just started using Letterboxd a little bit more, and I don't know, I don't use it a lot anymore, so I guess this is not a thrilling review, but I think someone like you would absolutely love it because it allows you to make, you know, top 10 greatest and, you know, different lists and things like that with notes. So anyway.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah.
Letterboxd without an E at the end.
Yeah, I just logged in, so apparently I do have an account on this thing. So Lasseter talks a lot about a lot of these. If you're interested in filmmaking and the kind of the how we're going with the future of film, check out these videos that they did, the speeches they did. We'll post them in the show notes. But yeah, so anything else you want to say, Ben?
That's it, Brandon. I guess since it's here in the notes, I talked about it a couple episodes ago. I think it was in the future of storytelling.
Oh, yeah.
I also went to a panel / conference called IO, EYEO, which is not Google IO. Anyway, it's like a nerd joke. A really, really interesting documentary that I've mentioned before on the show called Clouds. It finally was released, and this is a little bit old news by the time you hear this on the podcast, but it's really worth checking out if some of the things we've talked about in the past of what is the future of, you know, documentary filmmaking, and this is a classic case study, what is this, a business show? That's horrible. I'm sorry. Clouds is filmed with the Kinect camera and a regular DSLR. But what's amazing about it is they spent, and I actually got to ask the James George is one of the key figures on the film, or the project, really. That's the thing, is it kind of transcends film in a little bit of an interesting way, in that they spent years creating this whole thing because it's interviews with creative coders, basically nerds. Let's just, you know, it's interesting nerds talking about their work. And what's fascinating with the documentary is because it's filmed in this kind of faux 3D with the Kinect, you really have to just see it to even know what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. As they're talking, you can use the mouse to shift your perspective on their interview, but then also you can see portions of their work, different code projects and art, generative art is what it's kind of turned. Anyway, check it out if any of that sounds kind of interesting. It's really different, it's not a 2-hour documentary. The great thing is it's I'm running out of words here, but you get to choose your path through the documentary. That's what's fascinating about it, is that you are given kind of these intro questions of like, what is the, I don't have it open right now, but it's a lot of these questions about creativity of like, what is your process, or what is, you know, what is the way to start these things, right? And so if you can kind of ignore the questions actually, which is really interesting, or when you find one you're interested in, as if you click on it, it'll take you into that kind of section, right? So it's not completely unheard of in the way they do it. But then as you're in any of these interviews, you can see to the left or right, kind of at the edge of the screen, options to jump over to other areas, or you can watch the film kind of like based on theme or based on interview. I don't, it's really, really worth just at least seeing the trailer to understand what I'm even talking about, right? Because it is difficult to explain. But anyway, it's out now. Yeah. I think it's $10. It's just, but I think you can watch it, most of it, for free on the website. But if you want to download it to kind of have it, I got a copy of it, and it's a fantastic kind of glimpse at where things could be going or will be going, depending on how you kind of view things. So
yeah, we'll have that all in the show notes for you. Anything else that you saw, Io, that you found interesting
besides Brandon? I'm so tired and sweaty in Portland. It's we're gonna have to. Well, you know what? I'm going to just drop little goodies from throughout the future episodes of, okay. of things. There's a lot of great things that I don't want to just tack on here at the end. So
I understand. I don't want
to shortchange them.
We'll bring it up in future episodes. Also, too, thank you guys for tuning in. We've got a lot of downloads the past few months. Thank you for the support. You can
Our best, basically our best month. Second best month? Best month?
Third best month.
Doesn't matter. Brandon, what's happening? I thought we were doing better.
No, we're it's our the past 2 months. I'll say it's our best 2 month period. I'll say that it's our best 2 month period.
No, here's the thing, Brandon. I want to go ahead and say I'm so grateful that anybody listens to this. I'm shocked at every turn that anyone is listening, because I'm. This is the nice thing I'll say to you, Brandon. I'm just grateful to be able to do this. As dumb as that sounds, I really enjoy it. So my goal from day one has been more than one download, victory. So thank you for helping me achieve victory every month. It's been fantastic. So. Yeah.
And also we want to thank you guys for supporting us. Also like to thank Dusty Fields for our score for the show.
And I have one more thing too, Brandon.
Oh gosh.
And we do need to thank William Mason. I know, I'm sorry. It's because my brain's fried. We're gonna have some cool interviews coming up. We've started to reach out to people. If we haven't already reached out to you and you think that you're a good person for the show, just tell us.
Yeah.
I want to have William Mason back on to talk about Apple Music. That's the other thing I wanted to say. But speaking of William Mason.
Yeah, William Mason.
Thank you for the logo.
For designing our logo for Cinenation. Also, someone we kind of haven't thanked that I'll thank, because he kind of started off with our getting some of our social media stuff up and getting our Google Docs and everything. That's Hunter Barcroft, who hopefully will be on the show.
And we're going to have Hunter on the show. Yeah.
We're going to have Hunter on the show at some point. You can follow us on Twitter at Cinenation Show. You can like us on Facebook. Ben, what's your Twitter handle since you don't do Facebook?
I am sweet. No, I do exist on Facebook, shamefully, and I wish I could leave. But Twitter, I am sweet22, SUITE22. It's, you know, old school.
Yeah, I am at @BCS_thefilmkid. Much longer than Ben's. Send us
characters in the world of Twitter.
send us questions you have. Tell us what you're watching. If it's a Netflix show, if it's a film that you're watching that you love, that you've seen recently, tell us. Also too, if you want to be a guest on the show, if you think you have something to say, tweet us or send us a message on Facebook, or someone you think would be good for the show that you might know. We are willing to listen.
Well, and let's tease another topic, since you're frustrated with how many times I've interrupted you now. It's games. Okay.
Yeah,
we're gonna have hopefully Jonathan Norris at some point on to talk about some of the really interesting things going on in indie games. He and I were tossing back and forth a couple games that we've been playing, and you know, there's a lot of crossover now, more and more into these same topics of narrative and things like that. So
yeah, and
there's so many stories to be told on the future episodes. Stay tuned.
This is only our 11th episode, so we have a lot of stuff in store for future
hundreds
episodes.
More to come.
Let's hope.
We're announcing the sequels before the prequels have come out so that we can do a reboot later. The franchise will live on. It'll be a connected universe. Is that what they say? Connected universe?
Yes. They will be connected. Good night. Thank you guys for tuning in. Thank you for supporting us. Continue to download. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Give us any reviews on iTunes, too, because we learn from those. Again, thank you guys for tuning in. See you next time.